Iran, 1979. This gun feels so clean. This gun feels so shiny. This gun feels so heavy. I like this gun more than my prick. I like this gun more than my beard. I like this gun more than my wretched upbringing and my poverty. I like this gun more than my education. This gun slugged the general and took the eyes of the police chief. There is blood on tiles, chairs, filing cabinets. There are bodies on the floor and in drawers. We show the bodies to the world's media. We love our revolution. I wrote that, let me think, probably not until, say, 15 or 20 years after the events that the poem describes. I used to work as a video editor on television news. And that work took me to all sorts of places in Africa and the Middle East and Europe. And the big story in 1978 and 79 were the changes which were happening in Iran, inasmuch as the old regime of the Shah gave way to the Islamic regime led by the Ayatollah Khomeini. So I was in Iran both before the revolution happened and just after it happened, and then another time later. And what one saw, apart from the obvious change, was how young men were now armed with Kalashnikovs and were going around in jeeps. And they were, as it were, the new force of authority in the country. And they were very young. And one felt that somehow just being armed with an automatic weapon gave them a sense of masculinity which they hadn't had before. And I felt that was possibly the same in all great upheavals, that suddenly people feel enfranchised, but what has caused them to be enfranchised is just having a weapon. So I was kind of rather disturbed by it. And in the last stanza, when I talk about the bodies on the floor and in drawers, when you're an editor of news footage, you see a huge amount of stuff which doesn't actually get on the screens because it can be so gory. And this was the time when people who had supported the old regime were just being dealt what they called revolutionary justice, which basically meant they had 5 minutes in court and were taken out and shot. So it was, in a sense, quite a traumatic thing to witness. But that's how it was. I actually started off feeling very nervous about writing creatively. In the latter part of my career in film and TV, I wrote a lot of my own scripts, but they were all very kind of factual programs. And I felt that I was a good writer, but the nature of the programs I was making didn't allow for a great amount of creativity. And eventually I thought, I've got to write more creatively. And so I suppose it was about 12 years ago I started writing poetry and short stories. And then eventually I summoned up the courage to read some of this material to an audience. And that would have been probably 10 years ago. And I've basically been doing that ever since.
At what point did you, if I'm assuming you do now, you probably would consider yourself a poet, but at what point after you'd starting getting into writing more creatively, did you think that, I don't know, did you feel a change? Was it sort of when you read to other people, or did it?
Yes. I tell you, the most rewarding aspect of the whole thing is when you do a reading and someone comes up at the end and says, I really like that poem, it resonated in me somehow or other. Or even better is when someone comes up And they said, I remember you reading a poem at a gig about a year ago, and they can still quote a line from the poem. And I think somehow or other, it obviously lodged in their mind and meant something to the extent that they can, maybe inaccurately, but they can still repeat it that amount of time later. It's just so rewarding that you think you've done something which has meant a little bit to someone
Yeah.
else. So that is even better than having a book come out or being asked to do gigs, is just the fact that you feel that you've left an impression with someone.
No, that's great, because actually I was going to ask, because you've had some things published in books as well. I suppose I was just curious if it's more interesting to when you're actually doing readings and you're sort of meeting your audience, so to speak.
I don't know if many people would come to a gig because they have a copy of my book or books. What I hope is that on the strength of what I read, they might buy the book. But I was quite fortunate in as much as fairly soon after I started doing readings, I was approached by the Tall Lighthouse, and their editor stroke publisher, Les Robinson, asked me if I wanted to do a book. And so my first book came out, it was called Airport Reading, and that I think was 2004. And then this book, my second book, There Is Violence in These Vapours, came out in 2000 and I think seven, yes, 2007. Then a little pamphlet came out in 2009, and hopefully I'll have another book in a year or 2 years from now.
Yeah, that's my other question, which I was probably going to leave to later. But so does having books, does that make you feel like might I don't know, like people might take you more seriously, or is it just sort of a bonus?
Suppose it means someone's taken me seriously. I suppose it means that. I never wanted to go down the route of self-publishing because I think, yes, obviously you can self-publish, but you don't have another voice looking, another person looking at what you've done and criticizing it. And I quite like the process of having someone else look at all my work and saying, no, those are no good, that's too long, we can tweak that. That can all be useful. I mean, I tend to stick to my guns, but it's still good to have that kind of interested criticism. So the fact that I was able to publish with what is now a recognised poetry publisher was, hugely beneficial.
So how did they find you?
I think Les must have seen me read a couple of times, and I used to be a very regular reader at the Poetry Cafe in Covent Garden, and I used to do other gigs all around town, as I still do. So I think when I joined Tall Lighthouse, he probably had about 15 poets already. Now he probably has about 50 or 60. So in those terms, I was a kind of early bird.
Do you read other things that they publish? Do you sort of, I don't know, trust his taste, so to speak?
I don't like, I mean, I'll be frank, I like some of his poets a lot. Ephie Mannix, I like very much. There's a poet called Ebele, whose work I like, and Ronnie McGrath. But I don't like all his poets. I wouldn't pretend to. And that's the same with all poetry. You're bound to have your likes and dislikes. But I think they're a very good publisher. They're very proactive. They put on events, and I think they are now attracting quite a lot of attention.
I think yeah, you've got some more poems in your book in front. I think you
I'll
need
read
to do
this
that.
one. This is actually probably my favourite poem of all the ones I've written, and it's called Jazz Days. No smoking on this flight. No smoking on any flight, but enough alcohol to kill a sheep. The stewardess's smile could crack the airframe. I want to take her to a smoke cellar where the sprawling piano melody is as infectious as gonorrhea, and the wild rhythm staples the pulse, and she burns her lungs with flaming French cheroots and bites my ear and pushes me to the cloakroom to force her thighs. and the hard, thick leather tongue of Africa, slides below at 13,000 metres, and differing factions there insist on their own music. I wrote that one. I gave myself a holiday in South Africa. I think it was in the year 2000. And flying home from South Africa, it struck me what an antiseptic environment it is inside an aeroplane. And I was never a heavy smoker, but I did like a cigarette occasionally. And this was fairly soon afterwards they had banned smoking on flights. And I was probably itching for a cigarette. So the opening lines about no smoking on this flight reflected my feelings about that at the time. And what I think the poem does is combine three worlds. There's the antiseptic world inside the aeroplane, and my imagining of a smoky basement club where they play jazz. Somehow I imagine something in 1950s Paris. So the second part of the poem is all about me taking this attractive stewardess to a jazz club. And I was rather inspired by some of the writings of Aeneas Nin, who wrote quite erotic prose. And in one of her stories, there is an incident whereby the woman protagonist takes a young Arab lover into the cloakroom in order to make love on the floor. Kind of quite a charged image, really. And then I think the poem brings us back to the fact that we're flying over Africa. And I was looking down at the landscape of Africa, which from 39,000 feet looks like leather. It's a sort of brown, parched landscape. So when I refer to the thick leather tongue of Africa, it's the idea that that's what I'm looking at. And down there, in the very last line, I say differing factions there insist on their own music. In other words, there will be people down on the ground in Africa with their own concerns, not concerned with the planes flying so high overhead, but working out how to live their own lives with their own music. So I thought it was a way of combining these thoughts into one succinct poem. Whether my readers or listeners get that, I don't know.
As we mentioned earlier, Graham's been writing for about 12 years now, so I asked him whether his style has changed over the years.
I think in terms of subject matter, I'm getting more serious and dark.
That can only be a good thing.
I used to write a lot of fairly light, cheeky poems, which would raise a laugh in a reading. They seem to have disappeared now. Maybe it's the fact that I am getting old. One thinks of one's imminent demise. But I do tend to write more about death and illness, and not just thinking about myself, but I've gone back into my parents' generation and my parents-in-law's generation. And I have written poems about some fairly grim events to do with the Second World War, for instance.
I think it was probably on the poetry. It's gone now, but something that you hate in other poetry, you don't like self-indulgence, which is makes sense. But I was wondering, how do you manage to avoid that yourself?
I suppose you have to ask the question, is this interesting to other people? I mean, a lot of art is autobiographical, and there's no problem with autobiographical art. I think of D.H. Lawrence, who's still one of my favourite writers, and nearly all his novels were based on aspects of his life. But he wrote them in a way where you felt there was a universal message, be it about how men and women relate, or the nature of government, or what it means to follow a religion. It's all in D.H. Lawrence's work. But you don't think, it's not as if you're reading a diary. And if you take painting, some of the greatest paintings are self-portraits, but you feel there's a universal truth being presented to you. But if autobiographical writing is simply about someone whinging about their place in the world and how awful it all is, it becomes tiresome. And I think that's what I was trying to get at. So I think you just have to ask all the time, if you're writing about your own life, is this really valuable to anyone else, or am I just feeling sorry for myself? And if I think I'm feeling sorry for myself, I'll just not pursue it. I'm a bit hard-nosed like that.
No, I think that's really good advice for any poets out there if they're listening.
You do. I mean, without wanting to be overly critical, at some open mics you do feel that people are just spilling the beans about their love life or how awful it all is, and it just becomes a bit tiresome.
Mm.
Make it so that people can relate to it, and you've got a poem.
Oh yeah, I was kind of hoping we'd finish with the poem. So before we do the last one, I was wondering, did you want to talk about the, you mentioned earlier a project you'd embarked on with a young illustrator.
Yes, there's a young graphic artist called Maria Sagan, who's very talented in my opinion. And she approached me after I did a reading once and said, I want to illustrate some of your poems. And I was in two minds about that, but I thought it's worth pursuing a little bit. So we exchanged emails and I sent her a few poems and said, see what you do with these. And I was very impressed by the initial results. I thought she got to the essence of the poem and wasn't distracted by anything, any little points of detail, or anything peripheral. And so we pursued it. And the plan is that hopefully before the end of this year, we will be able to present, probably in the form of an exhibition, maybe 12 or 15 of my poems as illustrated by Maria. There's no certainty that it's all going to pan out, but it's the first time really that I've collaborated with an artist in another genre. And I just think that her work is very good. And so if we do produce something which is pleasing to look at in combination with reading the poems, so much the better. So hopefully before too long that will be on show.
Yeah, I'd really like to see that actually, because obviously that's the kind of thing you imagine that would just be a book, but I think it'd be really nice to see it on the wall beforehand.
All I can say, I mean, you can Google Maria Sagan and see some of her work, and I think it's, you know, extraordinary, some of it. So good for her, and hopefully we'll have a nice project together.
Yeah.
Right, this last poem is a longer one, and it's called The Road from Königsberg. I'll tell you a little bit about how it came to be written. My mum died 25 years ago, and one thing she left me was a bookcase full of books. And for a very long time, I didn't even look at them. And then I took one book down at random, and it was a novel called Thine Enemy, written by someone called Philip Gibbs. And it was written just after the end of the Second World War. And Philip Gibbs had gone to Germany, the defeated nation, which was in ruins. And he constructed this novel about the people who had survived the war. And the novel starts in the city of Königsberg, which now doesn't exist because it was renamed Kaliningrad. And Kaliningrad is now part of Russian territory and has been since the end of the war. What happened was that in January and February 1945, the city was surrounded by the Russian forces and people were starving. And eventually, a huge number of people exited the city in order to be safe. And so my poem is built around some of the events described in the book. The road from Königsberg. Some were Nazis, some were not. The young women are at the edge of the city, digging trenches. Our brave boys further, in forests and villages, ready to repel the onslaught from the east. But it is cold, so cold. The snow obscures the outlines of the castle. The electricity is off. Father is out, scavenging for wood, bomb-blasted branches, charred timbers, boxes, sticks, anything to ignite the poor stove. We are allowed 180 grams per day of bread. I heard this morning that Lotta, dear Lotta, had killed herself and her children. We too have capsules. No one can leave. The officer who ordered the shooting of civilians trying to escape has himself committed suicide. 4,000 on the hospital ship, 2 torpedoes, all dead in the icy wastes. Some were Nazis, some were not. The orders have been withdrawn. Huge columns struggle out of the city, motor cars, carts, carriages, walkers. 200,000 citizens, elderly men, professors, artisans, grandmothers, nightclub girls, women of class, children. Prisoners of war, French, English, minded by elderly guards who saw it all before in Flanders. A few bedraggled Wehrmacht cut off from their units. The pace is plodding, intermittent. I see our column on the frozen road, kilometres into the grey distance. It is so cold, so cold. Snow sneaks in past the cracks in the canvas. But if we pause, we are butchered. This morning, 2 women, both mewing like animals. They carried bundles to the drifts at the edge of the road, fell over them wailing, and were hauled back by the strong arms of farmers. Babies. Father leads the horse. With me in the cart is Rosa, my cousin, and her 2 children, also Hilde, our maid, and her infant. We huddle and shiver and cut the hard bread into tiny pieces. Out of the lead sky come fighters, yaks, screaming like piccolos. Their guns patter and flash. The column is shot to pieces. Some die where they sit. Strong ones run for cover in the copse across the field. A horse falls apart. Purple entrails spill out and soak the snow red. The frame of a cart still burns in defiance of the cold. Death comes with the ticking of a watch. And now a bomber, low. I see the stick of bombs, how gracefully they glide. Vomited up is earth, snow, limbs. We are eels feeding on a nightmare. Some were Nazis, some were not. Father died near Könitz, later named Hunica. All the villages, towns and cities here would become Slavic. Borders will move. Maps are always political documents. But we head west to Berlin, to drawing rooms, music, family. But we hear Berlin is bombed to powder by the English. The survivors live in cellars, starving. Tobacco is the only currency. Women in furs sell themselves for a meal, and those that don't die of cold die of disease. Some of us were Nazis, some were not. But Königsberg, ah, Königsberg, Gotten Himmel, Kaliningrad, Kaliningrad, Kaliningrad.
Thank you very much to Graham for coming in and sharing some of his poems. One of his collections, There is Violence in These Vapours, is available from Tor Lighthouse, So if you Google them, they're a .co.uk one. You should be able to find it. And I've been reading it lately, and I highly recommend it.